Welcome to Tori Mecha Nachyomi with the OU Women's Initiative. My name is Rachel Besser, and today we will be studying Ezra Perek Bet, Chapter 2. In Chapter 1 of Ezra, we witnessed the stunning policy of King Cyrus of Persia, who allowed the Jews to go back to Israel and build the Beit HaMikdash under the leadership of Sheshbatzar, the prince of the Jews. Perek Bet is very long, as it is basically a list of the people who went to Israel. The Perek begins with a list of the leaders of the Jews. In Pasuk Bet, Asher Ba'u im Zerubbabel, Yoshua, Nehemiah, Saraya, Ra'alia, Mordechai, Bilshan, Mispar, Bigve, Rechum, Bana, Mispar, Anshei Am Yisrael. And these people, these that are named Zerubbabel, Yoshua, Nehemiah, Saraya, etc., these are the leaders who led the Jews to their homeland. The first two people mentioned, Zerubbabel and Yoshua, are going to emerge as the leaders of this generation of the Jews who make their way to a barren land. Zerubbabel is going to emerge as the political leader, and Yoshua is going to emerge as the religious leader. You may have noticed that Sheshbatzar, the leader from the last parak to whom Cyrus gave the vessels of the first temple, is not on the list. This leads some commentators to say that this parak, Perek Bet, is actually a second wave of Aliyah. Similar to the various waves of Aliyah, of people who came to Israel from the time that the state was formed until today. Other commentators, like the Ibn Ezra, think that Sheshbatzar is just another name for Zerubbabel, and this parak is a continuation of the first, giving more details as to who went. The list goes on mentioning the names of the families and then how many people went from that family. Verses 3 and 4 are a good example of typical psukim in this parak. Verse 3 reads, B'nei Parash Alpayim Me'ah Shivim Ushnayim. The family of Parash sent 2,172 people. And verse 4 is read in a similar vein. B'nei Shephatiah, Shalosh Me'ot Shivim Ushayim. The children of Shephatiah, the Shephatiah family, sent 372 people. The list goes on for 64 psukim, until we get to the final number of people who went to Israel, 42,360. At first glance, Perek Bet seems like a rather bland perek, just a listing of people. However, when you look a little bit deeper, you see a theme begin to emerge. The first thing we need to do is compare this list to the census taken in the beginning of Bamidbar, the last time that the Jews entered Israel as a people. That list starts rather differently. Listen to the cadence and the difference in the language of the verse in Bamidbar. Ve'yu b'nei Reuven, b'chor Yisrael, Told otam, lemishbachotam, levet avotam, bimisparshemo, legoglotam, kol zachar, mi ben esrim shana v'mala, kol yitzei tzava. These are the people from the tribe of Reuven, the eldest of the tribes of Yisrael. And this is their told otam, the registrations of the clans, according to their ancestral homes, as are listed by name, head by head. All of the males from the age of 20 and older, everyone who was going to go to the army. Now there, in Bamidbar, the Jews are arranged and counted by shevet, by tribe. Here in Ezra, it's clear that that's not going to happen because there is only one tribe, Yehuda. Just the tribe of Judah remains, with the tribe of Benjamin, Binyamin, included among the tribe of Yehuda. The 10 tribes have already been exiled, so the group of Jews who are living in Babylonia are only from the Judean kingdom, the two tribes that were left. Furthermore, the Jews in Bamidbar were being counted for a purpose. They were going to be counted as an army, and therefore they only counted males from age 20 and up who were going to be able to serve. They were going into the land of Israel in order to capture it as their own. The Jews here are much weaker. They're not going into Israel as a conquering army. They are going as subjects of a king who lives back in Persia. They are not going to be their own masters. They're going to have to continue to bend to the will of Cyrus, even though he is certainly showing himself to be a benevolent king towards them. We also see from the listing in Bamidbar that there are many different words used of categorization and organization. We have the words toldotam, lemishpachotam, Beit Avotam, Mispar Shemot, Gilgalotam, 1, 2, 3, 4, five different types of categorization, the registration of the clans, their ancestral house, listed by name, heads of the family, according to their organization. And here in Ezra, they're only mentioned as head of the household. This indicates to us that they didn't have this type of organizational system as they did in the time of Bamidbar. While they were still listed by family, they didn't have this rich lineage history that they had in the time of the tribes that were entering Israel in the time of Moshe and Yoshua. This leads us to understand that the group now is not as structured and perhaps much more diverse, disorganized than they were earlier. And the diversity of the group becomes more apparent as we approach the end of the list. Psukim 43 through 54 list the names of the families of Netinim who came to Israel. Now this word Netinim is difficult, and the commentators explain that these Netinim were actually Givonim. If you remember the story of the Givonim from Sefer Yoshua, the Givonim were one of the original seven nations who lived in Eretz Canaan, in the land of Canaan, before the Jews got there. These Givonim tricked Yoshua into making peace with them by pretending that they lived far away and had traveled on a great journey to go meet Yoshua. And Yoshua subsequently made peace with them because there was no problem making peace with a nation that did not live in the land of Canaan. However, after they found out who they really were, Yoshua allowed them to live and stay in Israel, but they became menial workers who worked for the Beit HaMikdash by chopping wood and carrying water. And the commentators say that this is who these Netinim are. Now, it's just interesting to have this group of Netinim on the list. Let's go further before we really parse this out. The list of Netinim is followed in Psukim 55 to 57 by the B'nai Avde Shlomo, the children of the servants of Shlomo. Now here we have two groups of people, both the Netinim and the Givonim and the servants of Shlomo, who seem to be not Jewish, who are on the list. These are both groups of people who have lived for hundreds of years amongst the Jewish people, but somehow maintained a non-Jewish identity and lived seamlessly among the Jews. It's fascinating that these are people who stayed with the Jewish people, retained their identity even through the exile, and now are coming back from the Galut and returning from the exile back to their land, Israel, even though they're not Jewish, and they are counted on the list and included in the number of people who go back to Israel. So already from the positioning of these Netinim and the B'nai Avde Shlomo, we know that this group is not going to be very monolithic. Forget the fact that it's not organized by tribes. We have people on the list who aren't even Jewish. But the list actually gets even more complicated in terms of Jewish identity, because the Netinim and the B'nai Avde Shlomo don't have a complicated identity. They actually have a very secure identity. They were accepted. They lived amongst the Jewish people for hundreds of years, and that worked. However, the next group on the list, who are counted in as 652 people, are as follows. Ela ha'olim mitel melech, Tel Harasha, Kruv, Idan, Imar, the group of cities that they came from in Babylonia, and Velo Yachlu Lahagid Beit Avotam Vizaram Im Miyisrael Haim. They were not able to say who their father's house was, and they were not able to identify whether or not they were from Yisrael. Were they Jewish or not? This group is now going to be very challenging. They don't have a Jewish identity like the first group of people, nor do they have a non-Jewish identity like the Netinim or the B'nai Avde Shlomo. Instead, they're not sure whether they're Jewish or not. Now, marriage is going to be very problematic for this group because they can't marry Jews in case they're non-Jews, and they can't marry non-Jews in case they're Jews. Now, we don't see how this issue plays out, but the very fact of their presence on the list shows, firstly, that the nature of Jewish identity is going to be complicated now in this era. And further, it shows that the dedication of this group of people to the land of Israel, even though they're not sure if they're Jewish or not, they're still dedicated to go on this difficult journey to be part of the rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash. And now we're going to talk about one last group of people with a complicated identity. And this is going to be even more interesting because these people turn to their leaders to help them navigate their complicated identity and solve their dilemma. And this group of people, it, reading from the now we're in the 60s, and says the following: Ubnei HaKohanim, Bnei Chavaya, Bnei HaKotz, Bnei Barzilai. Okay, so now we're talking about a group of Kohanim. Asher lakach mi benot Barzilai hagiladi isha veikra al shma. Okay, so we have a group of people who are Kohanim, or at least they say that they're Kohanim, and they married the children of Barzilai, hagiladi. So apparently he is from Menasha, and they took on their name, meaning they didn't have a Kohen name. They called themselves after their wife's family. Now, this would really not be problematic because Kohanim had something that was very important to them, and that was called Kitvam HaMityachasim. They had lineage documents, and the lineage documents were there to prove that they were actually Kohanim. Now, I imagine in the time of the first temple, you need these lineage documents so much because the kahuna, the priesthood, just passed really from father to son. So as a child turned bar mitzvah or whatever, that he would start working in the Beit HaMikdash, and since everyone knew his father, it wasn't so hard. The transition wasn't so hard. But now they've been in Galut, they've been in exile for a number of years, and that type of tradition has been lost. So these lineage documents become very important. Now, this group of people, they're not known as Kohanim, and Ela Bikshu Kitvam HaMityachasim V'lo Nimtza'u. And they look for their lineage documents, meaning they want to provide their lineage documents to prove that they actually are Kohanim, but they cannot. They cannot find them. They don't have them. And therefore, Vaigolu Min HaKuna, they are kicked out of the priesthood. Now, what do you do with a group of people that say that they're Kohanim, but they can't prove it? And the answer is that they are not able to work in the Beit HaMikdash when it will be built, because a person who's not a Kohen is chayiv mita, they're worthy of the death penalty if they do the avoda, they do the service in the Beit HaMikdash. Now, these two groups of people, the Kohanim of Bnei Barzilai and the people of Tel Harasha, present a problem for the new community. How do you deal with people who are a question mark? How do you deal with people who just don't know where they belong? They're not like the non-Jews, Netinim and Bnei Avdei Shlomo, who are certain of their identity. And this is a very early iteration of the contemporary question of who is a Jew, a question that has been considered now for centuries. So the Kohanim turn to Hatirshata, the officer, a leader that Rashi identifies as Nechemya, and Ibn Ezra says is someone important, but not necessarily Nechemya. And they ask him what to do about their in-between state. In Israel, when families stay together on their nachal, these types of questions probably didn't come up as much, as everyone knew everyone for generations. And even if they did come up, there was a rather easy way to answer them. You could ask a Navi, you could ask a prophet, or you could ask the Urim V'Tumim, the special breastplate that the Kohen wore, that Hashem would use light up letters to answer questions, and therefore they could figure out these types of questions. Hatershata responds in verse 63, Asher lo yochlu mikodesh hakdashim adamod kohen le'urim v'tumim. We cannot answer this question, and therefore you cannot work in the Beit HaMikdash and eat from the Holy of Holies and eat from the holy meat until a Kohen can ask the Urim V'Tumim this question and Hashem will answer. Hatershata responds, I have no wherewithal to answer this problem as we no longer have the Urim V'Tumim. It hasn't come with us back from the exile. In fact, there are five things that the Gemara Yoma lists as missing from the Second Temple. The Aron, including the Kaporet and the Kruvim, the angels that stood on top of the Aron, the Amud Esh, the fire that would come down from heaven and consume the Korbanot, the Shechina, God's heavenly presence, the Ruach HaKodesh of the Nevi'im, the prophecy, and the Urim V'Tumim. Basically, what all these things have in common is that they are manifestations of Hashem's divine presence in a miraculous way. Hatershata is noticing that we are living now in a time of uncertainty, which is reflected in the status of the Kohanim and the status of the Jews who don't know if they're Jewish or not. Therefore, he says the only way to resolve your problem that we know of is to go back to the old system, the system of direct communication with Hashem, in which Hashem could answer this question of uncertainty. Unfortunately, he notes that that system is no longer available. They do not possess the Urim V'Tumim to answer their questions of identity, nor do they have prophets who could elucidate the problem for them. The only answer that remains for them is to live in the uncertainty. And safek lahachmir, if you are not sure, you must take the strict route. This uncertainty is going to be a linchpin for the contribution of the new age of Bayit Sheni, of the Second Temple. While prophecy was waning, something else was ascending, the rabbinic system, that would focus on Torah Baal Peh to answer these types of problems, not through prophecy or the Urim V'Tumim, not through miraculous means, but through a human system of understanding and answering questions. In summary, what we have here in Perek Bet is a list, and it's a list that looks on the surface to be very simple. But when you get into the meat of the list, what you see is that we are elucidating the issues of this community and its potential contribution. The people are not as organized, they are not as strong, and yet they show tremendous dedication to go to Israel when it's going to be difficult for them. They are not going as conquerors, they are going as settlers. They are not going with miracles, but they are going with their own sense of purpose and their own job to do. Thank you for studying Ezra Perek Bet together, Le'ilo Nishmat, Malka Esther, Bat Zvi Yosef.